HRHeadquarters.ie, the podcast.
Brought to you by Irish Life Health.
Okay, so today I am joined by Jenny Martin. Jenny is Senior Associate with William Fry. Jenny, thank you so much for joining the HR Headquarters podcast.
Hi, Declan. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
No problem. Do you want to just tell us what you do?
Yeah, sure. I, as you say, work with William Fry on the employment and benefits team. We have one of the biggest employment teams in the country. And we're, as always, very busy trying to stay ahead of all the employment law developments. And so hopefully we can touch on some of them today to assist anyone in HR or anyone with responsibility for employing anybody.
With that in mind, I'm going to, there's been some legislative changes or upcoming ones at the moment or ongoing at the moment. EU Transparent and Predictable Working Conditions Regulations 2022. What can you tell us about that, or what should people be aware of?
Essentially, what that does is expand on the terms of Employment Information Act 1994. So since 1994, there's an obligation on all employers to provide employees with certain terms and conditions in writing. So if that happens, or if the employer does that, they are compliant then with their requirements. There's been a range of updates by these regulations, and some of the terms have to be provided to employees within 5 days, and other terms have to be provided within a month. So obviously what employers have to do is double check their templates contracts to make sure that they're compliant and that they reflect the updates. And there's a couple of specific ones that are probably worrying employers that we might touch on in a little bit of detail. But what I would say, though, is that whilst employers might comply with the legislation and give employees what they need in terms of written terms and conditions, it is an opportunity for employers to go that one step further and put a contract in place. So it's not a legal obligation to have a contract in place, but it's to the employer's benefit, of course, if there is, because those written terms then can contain obligations on the employee, like, for example, to do with confidentiality, or maybe the notice that we want employees to give us before they leave, or what they are not allowed to do after they leave, all those sorts of things. So if we can get that into a written contract signed by the employee, then we're far better off. And of course, we've a far greater chance of getting that done or achieving that before the employment starts, or certainly within the very first few days. Because as soon as it goes past, there's no obligation on an employee to sign up.
And Jenny, what are the obligations? Just remind me, what are the obligations in terms of what, I mean, there's certain things the employer has to provide within, is it 30 days? Are you correct?
Yeah. So there's 5 days. There's certain ones that have to be provided within 5 days. And then there's others that have to be provided within a month. And they're all kind of really obvious things, I suppose. Like what does the employee need to know? They need to know who's employing them. They need to know where they need to go. They need to know when they need to go. They need to know what they're doing. And those sorts of things. But failing to provide those is actually a criminal offence. And there's obviously sanctions and whatever else. So something definitely to be taken seriously. And employers should definitely review their template contracts.
Not only is it an obligation, but it's an opportunity for the employer to get some of the other things in writing effectively and signed.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so, that's why I think we should just take advantage of it and make sure we're compliant, like all employers are compliant, but that equally we're getting something out of it.
And Jenny, the one thing that jumped out to me was the changes to probation and how people need to handle that. Do you want to just expand on that?
Yeah, sure. So there's probably a couple of things that are being discussed more than others. The probation is obviously one of them, as you say, and parallel employment, or you know, non-exclusive employment, is probably the other. So in terms of probation, that has been capped now at a period of 6 months, unless there's exceptional circumstances in the interest of the employee that it should be longer or extended. So as a matter of course, probation periods shouldn't exceed 6 months. And then if it's necessary to extend that, then you have to have some rationale for that. And the rationale has to be in the benefit, to the employee's benefit. So my immediate sort of thought was, and of course, we'll have to wait and see what pans out in case law or, you know, how it's interpreted. But my immediate thought was that if at the end of a 6 month probation period, an employer was considering that the person was not suitable for the job, well, it's certainly in their interest to extend the probation period beyond 6 months to give them a further opportunity to settle into the job and to meet the expectations. So I'm going to guess that that'll be a reason to extend the probation period. But other than that, it is 6 months. So really important to diary forward, you know, like, so you got your start date, your probation 6 months, diary forward 3 months, and diary forward again well in advance of the 6 months. And if somebody, but if the person's not suitable, that they're told of the difficulties, given an opportunity, and that the probation is either extended or the employment is terminated.
And they've doubled down on the need for you to make a written communication to the employee, isn't that correct, to let them know that they have passed or they've failed probation, or the alternative is they have 100% passed it.
They've passed it, or that it's being extended. Yeah, that has to be in writing. And really, that, you know, in order for an employer to rely on somebody not passing probation, it would have to be, there has to be some written records.
And that was already in the Irish law, wasn't it? But this is just making it absolutely crystal clear in terms of the written part of it, as opposed to the communication in general.
Yeah, like I say, like we see it all the time. If somebody is trying to defend against an unfair dismissal for somebody who doesn't pass probation, you know, and the question always is, well, did they know? Did they know they didn't pass probation? You know, so you won't be able to prove that they knew or they didn't know unless it's in writing.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's about being able to evidence it. And the non-exclusive employment, what's that aspect of it?
Yeah, so for the first time, it's now unlawful to prohibit somebody from taking up a second or other work whilst they're working with you, unless it's proportionate and unless the employer provides objective grounds why somebody can't take up another job. So there's some examples listed, and I would imagine that most employers would be able to find reasonable grounds to prohibit dual employment where it's appropriate. But like, for example, they might say that they need to protect business confidentiality, you know, so certainly you couldn't have employees going off working for competitors whilst they work for you. And I think that'll be reasonable and should, you know, that you'd be able to stand over that. The other thing that also kind of springs to mind, though, is complying with the working hours legislation. So obviously there's an obligation on all employers to make sure that employees are not working more than a certain maximum number of hours, like 48 hours over an averaging period. So obviously if somebody has a second job, it's much harder to monitor that. So that doesn't mean, I don't think that's going to mean that they can't take up a second job. I just think it's going to need an employer's consent, and that would be reasonable to be able to monitor the employees' working hours.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the conflict of interest one, that's fairly straightforward. I think that's common sense for sure. But yeah, I mean, the practicalities of the Working Time Act elements of it are difficult, especially in days of GDPR where we wouldn't be able to share the data potentially with another organization. How do you see that playing out in practice?
Like in the end of the day, if an employee has two jobs and works between them, works more than 48 hours a week, now, you know, forgetting the averaging exercise, but more than their maximum working hours, I mean, they can essentially bring a claim against both of those employers for allowing them to work more than 48 hours a week. I think there's going to be a bit of goodwill, and I think there's going to be a lot of communication, really. And I suppose it really depends on the first job. the job that the employee does for you and what sort of hours and commitment they give to you. And that, you know, if it's a part-time job or a job that lends itself very well to a second job, well, then that's fine. But lots of jobs don't. And in that case, then it might be easier and safer to just not allow somebody to have that other job.
Yeah, and I think in HR, which I'm a part of, so I'm criticizing myself, I think the temptation there always is to take that more conservative approach just to make sure that you're not leaving the organization exposed. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think for part-time work, I think organizations will certainly need to be practical about it, but where you're in full-time employment, I can understand where the difficulties may arise.
Sure.
I'm going to take a quick break, Jenny, and when I come back, I just want to ask you about the changes to the whistleblowing legislation.
Getting buy-in on your people strategy can often be challenging, but it doesn't have to be. At Irish Life Health, we help HR leaders to unlock insights and make data-driven HR decisions. Join over 2,500 HR leaders who partner with us to help their employees live a healthier life. Search Irish Life Health to find out more. Irish Life Health Act is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Okay, I am here with Jenny Martin, Senior Associate in Employment Law. Jenny, whistleblowing, I'm going to have to prompt myself now to say this correctly, but the Protected Disclosures Amendment Act 2022, can you just talk us through what the relevant changes were?
Yeah, so I suppose there's been a couple of changes in this area. Last year, there was the case of Barania, which was widely discussed. And then obviously, as of the 1st of January this year, there's the 2022 Act, as you say. So I mean, whistleblowing is a tricky area. But I think the biggest risk to employers is the fact that an employee doesn't have to kind of label what they're doing as making a protected disclosure. You know, they don't have to name it. They could simply even be grumbling and later then try and say that grumble was a protected disclosure and comes within the remit of the legislation. So I think the biggest trick for employers is to provide training to anyone in management and in a supervisory capacity to make sure that they are alive to that fact, and then what comes within the scope of the protected disclosures legislation. So the 2022 Act has probably extended who's protected by the Act, and then it extends the meaning of a protected disclosure, like, so what is a relevant wrongdoing is extended. So I think there's a number of things I think that we need to consider, really. The first one is obviously to have a policy and have a procedure. And I think if the procedure is really well signposted, that an employee who wants to raise a concern, whether or not they even know it's a protected disclosure, but if they want to raise a concern, that they know where to go to and they keep it internal and that they use the channel. And if they use the channel, well, then the employer definitely knows that it's a protected disclosure because they're using it. So I think it's really important to have a decent policy, have a decent procedure, and make sure that there's good training and signpost and communicate the policy and procedure.
When you say have a channel, you mean have a specific channel for protected disclosures?
Yeah. So like to make sure that everybody knows that if they have a concern, like who to go to, how do they raise it? How do they say it? But as I say, and I know it's a bit scary, but like, you know, an employee can grumble and then retrospectively say that comes within the definition of a protected disclosure. But they are obviously far more likely to use a procedure if it's signposted.
And within the amended Act, there's different timelines, isn't there, for different types of organisations?
Yeah, that's right. So since the 1st of January, all public organizations and private organizations with more than 250 employees have to have a policy and procedure in place. And then from the end of this year, that will extend to organisations with more than 50. But as I say, I think if there's if there is a procedure, it's far easier to manage these things. Do you know, the likelihood is that somebody will actually put their hand up and say, I have a concern and I'm going to follow this procedure over here, you know, and then it's easier to manage. But of course, I mean, it doesn't, like, the other funny thing, I suppose, about whistleblowing is that in an ideal world, you would hope that if I come to you and say, Declan, you'd never guess what they're doing across the corridor, they're committing acts of fraud or something, that you would say, oh, Janie Mac, that's terrible. Let's go and find out what they're doing and make sure that it stops and that everyone's doing what they're supposed to be doing. And if that happens, regardless of what I've said, if that happens, well, then there's no issue. The issue only arises if I say, oh, Declan, Janie Mac, you wouldn't know what's happened across the corridor. They're committing acts of fraud. And then a week later, I'm fired or I'm demoted or I'm not promoted when I should be. Or so if there's some action being taken against somebody, like if the employer is thinking, oh, we need to select people for a pool for potential redundancies, or we're thinking about terminating Jenny Martin's employment or whatever, they need to think, has this person raised a complaint? Has this person raised a whistleblowing or protected disclosure complaint or any complaint actually? And know that, you know, that that's out there, I suppose, before any action is taken against somebody. Yeah, and of course, the action taken against somebody is also being expanded. So what is detriment or penalization has been expanded as well. So so again, just to better protect employees who do raise concerns.
And what's come into scope that was out of scope previously?
That is a good question. So withholding training, a negative performance review, negative reference, withholding promotion. There's a whole list of things.
Yeah, it's an interesting area. I do find it fascinating.
The other important development as well, actually, is the fact that they've reversed the burden of proof. So maybe the easiest way to explain that is by reference to an unfair dismissal. So I appreciate I'm going slightly off topic, right? But if an employee claims unfair dismissal, they go to the WRC, they tick the box, they arrive at the WRC hearing and they sit down and they listen, because the burden of proof rests on the employer to prove that the dismissal was fair and justified. In a constructive dismissal, that burden of proof shifts. So the employee says they have been constructively dismissed, goes to the WRC and has to prove that what the employer did was so bad that they had no alternative but to treat themselves as having been constructively dismissed. And it's the same in this one. So under the old regime, the employee had to prove that the detriment or the penalization that they have suffered is directly as a result of them having raised a protected disclosure. And now that burden of proof has shifted. So if somebody brings a claim pursuant to the protected disclosure legislation, it is for the employer to prove that whatever the penalization or detriment suffered was caused because of something other than the protected disclosure. So the employer is straight away on the back foot.
Did I read correctly that there's a subtle change in terms of the reporting channel, or not channels, maybe a bad description, but where you go first? Does the employee now, are they funneling people more internally first? Did I read that correctly, or am I making that up?
No, so there's nothing to stop somebody going external if they need to do so or feel it's appropriate to do so, but they're certainly trying to signpost the internal procedures. But the other subtle difference that you might have seen was the fact that the communication with the person who made the protected disclosure has changed significantly. So previously, under the previous regime, the employer could say, oh, thanks very much. Thanks for letting me know that there, Declan. Now off I'll go and do whatever it is that I think is appropriate. And that's the end. That's the end of it as far as you're concerned. But now the employer is obliged to keep the person who made the protected disclosure in the loop. So they have to say the steps that they're taking in terms of the investigation and the outcome and action taken by the organization as a result of the protected disclosure. Of course, that doesn't extend to, so if somebody is the subject of disciplinary action as a result of the protected disclosure having been made, well, obviously the subject and the outcome of a disciplinary action against somebody else isn't anything to do, it's private. So you're not going to tell the person who made the protected disclosure that, but otherwise they have now an entitlement to know what happened as a result of the protected disclosure.
Yeah, that makes sense, to be fair, rather than it just going into a black hole, so to speak.
Yeah. And the other thing that always has to be considered is that, well, obviously a person who feels that they have, well, if a person feels that they have been terminated because of a protected disclosure that they made, they obviously have a right to recourse they can go and seek an injunction within 3 weeks to the circuit court. And they have that sort of additional protection, that protection in addition to whatever claims they might have to the WRC. But, you know, major considerations at that stage, I think, for employers is like the cost of responding and dealing with those proceedings, and also the publicity that they're likely to attract. I mean, whistleblowing just by their nature tends to cause great fanfare and excitement and in public interest. And whether or not there's any merit to the disclosure that has been made, whether it's protected disclosure or not, like whether even if it's all incorrect or inaccurate or misunderstood, it's so hard for an organization. They're totally on the back foot trying to say defend proceedings, and it's been plastered all over the media, and it doesn't even make any sense. You know, it's difficult to
it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because you 100% need the facility for someone when something is been done wrong to report it, absolutely, but you also don't want it being weaponized by people, if you like, in terms of misusing it. One last thing, and changing the subject, Jenny, while I have you and you take us on a whirlwind tour. Obviously we're all well aware, over the last number of years a lot of companies have gone to remote and flexible working, and it's just way more way more normal, shall we say, for office workers, certainly. What's happening in that space at the moment, if anything?
So it's a sea change. So the remote and flexible working is going to be dealt with by the work-life balance bill, which is still in draft. It's before the Shannon. Actually, I was listening to the Shannon debate last night, so it sounds like there's still a couple of items that are up for debate and to be clarified. So there's not much point, you know, going through the draft legislation in too much detail, because it has been changed a couple of times already and it may change again. The other thing that seemed clear from last night's Shannon debate is that whatever is enacted, and it should be enacted very shortly, but whatever is enacted will be reviewed in 2 years. And so it'll be a kind of a work in progress. So the work-life balance bill is going to cover such things as domestic violence leave. It's going to extend breastfeeding entitlements to 2 years. It's going to extend maternity leave to transgender males. It's going to provide for 5 days unpaid leave for serious medical-related reasons. And then, as you say, it's going to provide for flexible and remote working. So I think it's been useful to amalgamate flexible and remote working under the same piece of legislation in the work-life balance bill. But it is also important to distinguish between them. So flexible working is what work you do, when you do it, and how you do it. And remote working, obviously, is where you do it. So a flexible working arrangement is designed to be temporary, and it's designed for parents or carers with 6 months service to deal with serious medical reasons. So if they need to provide care as parents and carers, if they need to provide care to certain people, then they can request that a flexible working arrangement. Whereas on the other hand, remote working can be temporary or permanent, but is not restricted to parents and carers. So we'll have to see how that's enacted. I know one of the things they were debating last night was allowing flexible working arrangements more broadly, you know, providing for it more broadly. So not restricting it to just parents and carers for medical reasons, but just providing it for it more broadly than that. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, so it's a watch this space one.
Yeah, it sure is. And I mean, it's also interesting, you know, to see it playing out on the back of the pandemic. You know, I think if we were doing this pre-pandemic, I mean, what they're discussing probably sounds more proactive, you know, but like actually what they're providing for, what the legislation is providing for, is nearly sort of playing catch up after what we've had for the last 2 years. And it's interesting. It'll be really interesting to see how it all plays out. I mean, in the end of the day, this time last year, like in early 2022, we were still in very serious lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, there was still very serious restrictions. So we've come an enormous way, you know, so quickly. And it's easy to forget. Like, it just seems like a world away, doesn't it, this time last year? But equally, when people were in lockdown and had to work from home, there was a lot of concern across the board about people's mental well-being and everybody, I mean that generally now, obviously, everybody wanted to get back to normal, back to routine, back to the office. And of course, then once we're allowed back to the office and back to normal, nobody wants to do that.
Yeah, I know. It is funny. It's like most organizations where you have to work from home now, as opposed to, you know, the balance of power, I guess, and slightly shifted now, where the employees, well, a lot of employees certainly don't want to go back full time.
We'll have to see, but obviously there's, like, you know, I think over time, and as I say, we're still very early days, you know, over time I think we can see the benefits of being in the office and the benefits of collaboration and all of that. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see how people pan out, you know, in terms of what they would prefer to do.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree.
But what I should say is, between now and the legislation coming out, is for all organisations to think of, like, what suits the business? What do we need? What do we want our people to do? And what's the right thing for the business? Because whatever policy the business makes has to be made in light of that, you know, and then obviously we can allow for the legislation, but everybody should be considering what they would want to put in the policy.
Yeah, no, I think that's sensible advice. Jenny, I've taken up too much of your time already. Thank you so much. It was great to do a whistle-stop tour of some of the current employment law considerations. If people want to get in contact with yourself or William Fry and talk employment law services, what's the best way to contact?
Oh, you're more than welcome to find out all about us on williamfry.com. My email address is jenny@williamfry.com. You'll also find, actually, on the William Fry website, our recent report in relation to ESG and the social related aspects of ESG and the employment law, the related employment law to that.
Yeah, and while you were listening to Deshannad last night, I was possibly reading that, so it's very interesting. It is an interesting piece of research. So yeah, definitely encourage people to do it. Jenny, thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Declan.
HRHeadquarters.ie, the podcast.
Brought to you by Irish Life Health.